This is Mythical.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, hot doggers. So for the next 3 weeks, we're taking a little break because we got something really, really big cooking up. But for now, don't worry because we're not going to leave you hanging. We're going back to the vault to find our favorite episodes that we want to share with you again. And this one, Nicole, this is maybe my favorite episode that we've ever done.
That's right. It is the Ocean of Soup featuring Hank Green, who is an incredible, incredible guest.
Yeah, Hank Green. I mean, he is absolute YouTube OG, but he's also a science educator.
Yep.
And just one of those people who you listen to and you're like, oh, you're way smarter than I am.
Yeah.
And talking to people who are smarter than you, especially talking about such a dumb topic as is the ocean of soup, to me was incredible. And this is one of my favorite conversations we've ever had. And he took it like really seriously.
Yeah,
in that I respect.
We went down a philosophical rabbit hole of all of the options, ideas, opinions, philosophical debates. It was intense. It was really, really good.
And very specifically, my favorite conversations are ones that are with people who are smarter than me, mm-hmm. but I know more about one very specific thing than they do.
Nice.
So I can be like, aha, but if you were to actually make a soup out of the ocean.
Mm.
This episode is really, really incredible. I hope y'all enjoy it. Keep your hands and feet inside the ride at all times. Here we go. Jacques Cousteau once said, "The sea, the great unifier, is man's only hope." But does that mean that man's only hope technically lies in a giant bowl of soup? What the heck are we talking about today? This is a hot dog as a sandwich.
Ketchup is a smoothie.
Yeah, I put ice in my cereal, so what?
That makes no sense.
A hot dog is a sandwich.
A hot dog is a sandwich.
What? Welcome to our podcast, A Hot Dog is a Sandwich, the show we break down the world's biggest food debates. I'm your host, Josh Scherer.
And I'm your host, Nicole Handizadeh.
And today we are joined by science communicator, book writer, YouTube crash course co-creator, vlog brotherer, and the guy that all of TikTok turns to for answers, Hank Green.
Hello!
Hank, welcome to the show.
Hello, Hank. Thank you for coming.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming. Thanks you for coming on my podcast.
Right. Yes.
Yeah,
correct.
You're officially a co-owner of the podcast
yes,
now.
Yes.
That happened. It was
yeah,
part of the terms. So, you know, the reason that we wanted to have you on here is we have had Is the Ocean a Soup on our list for so long. Since the beginning. And there was pushback from both of us at different times anytime we'd actually meant to schedule it,
mm-hmm.
Primarily for the reason of it's too dumb. Not dumb. We treat all these questions with a certain amount of seriousness.
Sure, uh-huh. We always do, yeah.
But ever since we asked the question of when you eat a hot dog, does it technically become a hot dog inside your own intestines, we were like, maybe let's dial it back on the bigger things. But Hank, we saw your TikTok where someone asked you the question, is the ocean a soup? And you had a very, what I think is a profound answer. I mean, most of your answers to anything at least seem very profound to me. And so we wanted to have you on to discuss it, to flesh it out. I mean, can you kind of paraphrase your views on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I like ultimately, and this gets to kind of the root of what you do here. And I don't want to like say, all right, we've done, we finished. But you know, all language is created by us, and every, you know, in some way, every word means a slightly different thing to every person. Mm-hmm. And who gets to decide what a word means is, of course, us. And, but also we get to disagree about that. So in addition to us, it's me and it's you and it's you. So if you want the ocean to be a soup, then it's a soup, man. You did it. You could just do that in your own brain. You could make that decision. But of course, that's my way of being like, oh God, please don't involve me in these conversations anymore. And yet I have decided that I do want to come on the podcast and talk in a deeper way about whether or not the ocean is a soup. And also, if that makes me a soup, like what? Mm-hmm. Soup is a strange idea straight up. But like, if the ocean is a soup, then I'm definitely a soup. Just in a big skin bag.
I think more of like a tartare with like the raw meat.
Yeah,
to me,
if we're
going in the culinary classification, we were actually very worried that you wouldn't want to talk about this, primarily because the TikTok answer, it was a bit of like a, it was a somewhat of a punt. It was a very
Absolutely.
like, linguistically, philosophically, you know, ethical sort of punt. It was like, look, we all collectively decide as a society what words mean. But it also isn't that simple, right? Like there are a couple different theories in linguistics on when a word sort of becomes actualized. There's like the populist idea that once something becomes popular enough, and this is what, you know, Merriam-Webster is like very active on Twitter.
Sort of deciding.
And they're an absolute delight.
Yeah.
That, you know, what was the... Irregardless. A big one that people were, you know, sort of mad about, that Merriam-Webster officially recognizes irregardless as a proper word. And then you get a bunch of old school copy editors and English teachers being like, there have to be rules in a society. We need gatekeepers.
Weirdly, I was in the conversation about this very morning where there was a person who I don't know, but their tweet went through a couple of cycles and arrived at my eyes, and they had been criticized for using snuck instead of sneaked, because sneaked is the create word, like, you know, the past tense of peak is not puck. And this is like, you can look all over the place, and this hasn't happened to very many other words, but snuck just sort of snuck in, which is lovely. And but also I think for good reason, because snuck is so much better than sneaked.
Yeah, sounds so much better.
So they had been basically criticized for using snuck because that's the more uneducated past tense of sneak. And and the person was like, oh gosh, what do I do when I'm getting emails like this? The answer is, of course, ignore them, and then declare yourself to be 100% team snuck, which I am.
Yeah, I think I'm willing to put all my support
I'm
behind
team
snuck.
Yeah.
Well, this happened with my grandma, who is 99 years old. She's almost getting to the centenarian.
Yeah.
But she is also from South Africa, and she also, you know, South Africa obviously very politically divided, and especially, you know, also between the Dutch and the British. And so she was in the era where it was like you spoke the Queen's English. If you wanted to be in a certain echelon society, you had to speak the Queen's. And so I used the term dove as the past tense of dive. And she was like, well, what? It's dived. What are you talking? And I was like, Granny, that sounds straight up ignorant. You saying dived like that. I don't know if you know.
I say dived.
You say dived?
Yeah, I dived into this.
I dove into it. Hank, what do you say?
I have dove into
what British aristocratic grandmother raised you?
My mom, Sheila, and my dad, Morris, I guess. I don't know. I say dived.
But that's one of those things that there, it's like the spelling of judgment, whether you add an E after the G, it's very much a British Commonwealth American split.
Interesting.
To which there's no right answer. One might look intuitive to you, but not
true.
To another person who grew up with another set of rules.
Now, how does this apply to the ocean of soup?
Because we're talking about who, whether or not, because the general sort of claim that Hank made of, you know, who decides if the ocean is soup, it's you. If the ocean is soup to you, it is. But I think that there may be, we need to reach some sort of consensus, some sort of societal consensus to decide.
Right. And I'm like, so the soup, I think one of the main things about it is it is nutritive. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if I drink ocean, it is definitely not nutritious. It is not like, I'm not going from like, okay, I have a physiological need that must be satisfied. Ocean is in a very deep way not going to do that. Not only is it not going to provide me calories, I'm coming down hard and early. Not only does it not provide me calories, it will make me sick. Like, it will dehydrate me. You can't drink ocean because there's so much salt in it that it's like sucks the water out of your cells. And then you need to go and, you know, if you ever dove into the ocean, and swim around for long enough, you know, you need to get on shore and have a drink. Have a pina colada. So
what you're saying is the ocean is a condensed soup, the way that Campbell's sells condensed chicken soup.
So the ocean is both condensed and dilute soup. So one, you need to dilute the salt, but you need to condense the nutrition.
Well, it depends on what part of the ocean.
There's definitely calories in the ocean. Like there's fish. That's a thing that is often in soup, but there's also like algae that maybe, I don't know if we can get any of the chlorophyll out of that and make that into into energy for ourselves. But there's
we certainly can.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, there's tons of vegetables in the ocean.
Lots of vegetables.
I mean, people eat tons of kelp. You have kombu. I mean, you have so many different seaweeds that people have been eating for generations that do provide a lot of nutrients.
You can't just list one seaweed.
We got spirulina. What's the ogo from Hawaii? That's my favorite seaweed. That's a good one. You got sea grapes. You got sea fennel. Literally, you just put this is a big thing in the aquatic foraging movement that ended up in fine dining restaurants where they would put the word sea in front of like a normal land vegetable and then assume that we would know what it means. So there was do you remember sea grapes?
I love sea grapes.
Sea beans.
I'm very passionate about
sea lettuce. These were all things that ended up on menus and it was just like a green, crunchy, salty thing.
You guys remember menus?
I do. Good old days.
I didn't realize restaurants are all just doing QR codes on your phone.
Yeah, they are.
Which is my first restaurant experience back in society was at a BJ's brew house with my 99-year-old grandmother, fully vaccinated, first time leaving, you know, the home in a year.
Oh, sweet.
And she wanted pizza, so we took her to the BJ's brew house. And then when she asked for the menu and they said, "Oh, hello, 99-year-old woman, this is a QR code." I was like, no, society has already changed so much since they went into quarantine.
Past us all.
Okay, but if we're talking about taking the general proportions of the ocean and then compressing that into one microcosm,
right.
You know, one tiny microcosmic bowl of soup, then you'd be right in that it would be both condensed, too salty to eat, but also nutritionally dilute.
Yeah.
But if you took the right slice of ocean, if you just simply dipped a pitcher, this is the lengths that we are going to.
Right.
If you dipped a pitcher and you got a couple little like mud crabs, these things do not all live in the same tertiary level of the ocean, but you got some nice kelp, you got some nice little mud crabs to create a stock.
Got a sardine.
Yeah, you got a little seahorse, you know. You could, in theory, take that.
I love seahorse soup. That's one of my favorite.
I really wish
I could go back to the old days when I could go to the restaurant and get seahorse soup.
The worst thing is that if any show were to create it, it would be GMM.
That's very true.
And I'm so grateful every day that they have not asked me to procure a seahorse.
You eat a seahorse.
That's
hard line.
Next thing, I almost want to cut this in the podcast so Rhett and Link don't eventually hear that. But if you took the right proportion of ocean and you were to
boil that, I'm gonna stop you.
Go ahead.
Okay, I've Googled, can you eat a seahorse?
No.
And you know how Google like now is making it so you don't have to click a link, it just like appears like a box.
Yes.
And it says unfortunately seahorses are edible. And I'm like, who decided that it was unfortunate? I mean, unfortunate for the seahorse, certainly.
I suppose.
Yeah.
But like but fortunate for the ET, the person doing the eating. But I guess probably that they have put pressure on them through the harvest of seahorses. So
That makes sense.
Maybe be cautious about future seahorse consumption, everyone.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
To be clear, this is a thought exercise. I don't intend to eat seahorses.
Yeah, no, I sure don't.
I already made a video of eating octopus, and everyone who watched my octopus teacher really did not seem to enjoy that.
Yeah.
And I apologize.
Octopus happens. It's okay.
Is don't a more sustainable seafood. Anyways, point is, you could, in theory, take that perfect slice of ocean and then boil that down. You could even potentially desalinate it a little bit. We've all had soup bases that are too salty, right?
Sure.
You know, and I always run it through my pocket desalination plant.
But
and
I mean,
I keep in my home.
Yeah.
That's fair. But I mean, literally, so the way that bouillon is created, right? Chicken bouillon, if you ever use that in your home, it is literally stock that has been just dehydrated until it's a powder. So this would take a certain amount of culinary skill for the home chef to do, but you could boil that slice of ocean down until you created a sort of bouillon, right, that you could, in theory, take to space, and then take some of that out.
I mean, ultimately, to me, it only has to have a little bit of nutrition, and it has to not be poisonous. That's a soup.
If you have to do so many steps to get it to that point, then it wasn't a soup to begin with. You made the soup. You were the soup creator.
At what point did I create the soup? So the thing is, it has to. So now I'm like backing up and I'm saying, okay, I think a soup can be so salty that it dehydrates me. That's okay. I'm sure that there are soups like that. So it's very salty soup. The ocean is not a soup because if you just like took the ocean, there's just way too much water and not enough food. But if I like dip a spoon and in that spoon, there is a sardine.
Yeah.
And then I eat that. At that point, I feel like it's soup because it's nutritious, it's salty, and it's wet. And that's
just a wet sardine. No, that's just a wet sardine. You guys are not accounting. Let me stop you guys right here. You are not accounting for how horrible we treat the ocean. It is full of trash.
Where did we get? No,
the ocean it is full of trash. Sorry,
pollution deniers.
I'm saying the human species.
Uh-huh.
We pollute the ocean.
Nah.
There's so much oil in the ocean. Uh-huh. There's so much trash in the ocean. There's so much sewage in the ocean. If you had a bowl of ocean soup, you would die.
No.
Well,
you would have to go to the doctor. The
ocean and you just like get a mouthful and you swallow it. Because
well,
I have.
I feel like you'd have to go to the doctor if you ate a bowl of soup from the ocean.
The ocean is so big. Look, there's a saying in environmental work: dilution is the solution to pollution. You can't get rid of pollution, but there's always been stuff. Like, there's always, like, in certain parts of the ocean, you can't drink it. Like, you can't go down to a hydrothermal vent and, like, take that. Mm. And, like, that's going to be poison nasty,
that's
nasty
just
sauce.
A hot soup.
That's
just a nice, but, it's pre-warmed.
But you know, all of the fishes and whales are drinking the ocean, and they're okay. I mean, drinking. They don't have to drink, really. But the ocean is in and around them, and they're okay. I'm not worried about the poison. I'm worried about the salt. But There are soups out there that are so salty that I would compare them to the saltiness of the ocean. But I do like that's just a wet sardine. I think there's a case to be made that that's just a wet sardine.
Thank you.
Do you think you're more likely to dip a spoon into the ocean and pull up a sardine or dip a spoon into the ocean and just hit a BP oil spill? Honestly, which one is more likely?
Neither. It's a wet cigarette.
Well, yeah, that is much more likely.
It's a Yoo-hoo bottle. Okay. It's a drinking Yoo-hoo bottle.
Growing
Josh.
Up in the American public education system, I was raised to believe that the ocean is 90% the six-pack rings.
Yeah.
The rings that the six-packs of soda come in.
Yeah.
It is 90% dolphins stuck in those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now also turtles with the straws in their noses. Mm-hmm. Those are the only creatures in the ocean.
Yes.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, based on the YouTube content that
yes.
I consume.
Yes.
But to go to the wet sardine, I think people are talking about the wrong food when it comes to the ocean. Because I personally don't believe it's soup. If you have to take so many steps to it to make it an edible soup, I agree with the fact that if you get one sardine in that, that is just a very weak sardine-filled broth. But still, it doesn't have to be a good soup. It just has to be a soup. I would argue that the ocean is a giant jar of pickles. Because if you think about the salinity of the ocean, if you put cucumbers into just straight up seawater, they would lacto-ferment and they would become delicious Jewish half-sour pickles.
Oh my gosh.
The ocean is a giant thing. And also if you eat certain seaweeds, certain sea creatures, think about oysters, right?
Yeah.
Oysters have such natural salinity to them because they're swimming in pickle brine.
Well, yeah. So I think that the ocean certainly has pickles in it. The ocean has definitely brined some things, but not all of the things. And so, like, now I get to be myself and tell you that lots of organisms in the ocean pump salt out of themselves so that they are not as salty as the solution that they are in. And the whole point of pickling is that you have salt and vinegar and you, like, get it to seep into the pickle. But that doesn't happen
Correct.
To all living organisms in the ocean, though some it
Correct.
Does.
That's actually, because I mean, I was wondering about that because certain shellfish taste really sweet, like certain
yeah.
bivalves, you know, I mean, clams are incredibly sweet, whereas oysters, they're natural, I guess they're what we would call their liquor in the culinary world. Is that just seawater? I mean, what are they?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Uncle Hank, how do oysters work?
Boy, I don't know what a liquor is.
So it's a term for when you crack open a fresh oyster. I don't know if you're a fresh oyster guy.
No.
But if you crack open a fresh oyster, there's just a residual like pool of liquid that is sort of surrounding the oyster flesh. And that's referred to as like the oyster liquor. And it's like very prized because it kind of has that seawater quality, but I don't know if it's the oyster, you know, just its natural juices and secretions.
Might be.
I think oysters open when they are doing their like stuff, and so that would I imagine, but I don't know. It may be that like there's space inside of it that is just like the seawater gets in there, Or it may be that they are processing seawater and that the liquor is a some kind of excretion from the oyster. I don't know.
Yeah, Google.com is saying it's the natural juice that you find inside of raw oysters. So oyster whatever that
oyster
means.
Juice.
Oyster juice. juice. That's what that is. Now every kitchen can be a Mythical kitchen.
The Mythical cookbook is available now, so go to mythical.com/cookbook and get yourself a copy today. Okay, so we talk about the evolution of words, and that certainly happens in the culinary world all the time. I mean, obviously, we named our podcast after the sort of granddaddy of all of these debates, right? Uh-huh. Is a hot dog a sandwich? And that is something we have decided we will never talk about.
Nope, I don't want to.
It is merely the muse, the namesake of our podcast, we're not ready to get into that.
I don't think we ever.
One thing that people do often say to us is a hot dog is not a sandwich, it is a taco. And it got me researching the word sandwich in taco, because everyone knows the foundational myth of the sandwich, right? The Earl of Sandwich was playing a poker game. This is in the mid-17th century, I believe. Didn't want to get his cards dirty. And he was like, bread has been around for 4,000 years. Meat has been around for 10,000 years. Never before now has a person thought to put them together except I, the Earl of Sandwich.
Uh-huh.
And so thus the sandwich was created. But before the term sandwich, people were obviously putting meat. They would have been fools. Like, they discovered the heliocentric model, but they couldn't discover
bread.
What's going on? And so once a term gets created, ditto with tortillas, been around for 10,000 years.
Yep.
The term taco only dates back to the mid-1800s, but certainly they were describing
the Earl, and it was the Earl of Taco?
That is exactly what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, you know, words, the concepts have existed forever, but the words are very new. So ditto even for soup. The term soup is constantly changing. The original etymology of soup, it comes from Old Germanic. It specifically referred to a dish of broth poured onto bread to rehydrate it on old bread.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, which I think is really interesting. So even the original definition of soup has changed, which is why I argue that soup does not exist.
Much in the way
that there is no such thing as a fish, because it is a sort of broad, meaningless category that we have only used to, like, ascribe to things that kind of live in the ocean and don't give, like, live birth. That is, to me, what soup is. It just doesn't exist. It's just wet food, but then some wet foods are called sauces, some wet foods are called stews, and there's no defining characteristic. So part of me doesn't even want to entertain the is ocean a soup.
Then what's the point of the podcast,
man? I don't know anymore, man. Soup doesn't have a good time.
All right. First of all, some fish do give live birth, which continues to confuse our whole situation, including seahorses.
Really?
But the males give live birth, which is even weirder.
As a feminist, that's hot.
Sorry. That seahorse really gets my juices flowing. So ultimately, it comes down to the utility of a word. Mm. I think that you can't say that soup doesn't exist because I need a word for my wet foods.
Why? Why do you need a word for your wet
foods? Because I can't go into a restaurant and like have the section of the menu with soups on it say wet foods.
Why? But why? Why come? Why come, Hank? Why come you can't say that?
You can
just point to it on the QR code.
It's not that I have to say it out loud. It's that the chefs of the world need a good brand for that category of food. And just like salad, you know, like apparently a potato salad is a salad for some reason. Mm. Like, no, it's not. It's mayonnaise and potatoes. Just like that's more a soup than a salad.
Yeah, depends where you get it from, but no, I totally agree.
Well, talking about the soup breakdown of menus, a thing I'm always sort of fascinated with is at especially a lot of Chinese restaurants, there is a section of soups that will be, you know, if it's an American Chinese restaurant, hot and sour, egg drop, sizzling rice,
miso,
corn.
Yeah.
And then you will go to the noodle section, and a lot of those noodles are also coming in soup.
Right, right. And curry, curry is also often soup. Like in the curry section, you're like, oh, that's a curry soup to me. American.
I would agree, but again, these are cultural lines where everything's very blurry on what a soup is. And if we want to create, what is it, like the Kantian world state, you know, I don't even know what the, I read that. I heard that in one. You know, like if we want to all come together, okay, we need to create a one defining, you know, sort of modality for soup. And I don't think we have the ability to do that.
Right. But I also don't know that we, I also don't need that we all, we do need to come together in one world that, in which all, like everybody agrees that, because part of the joy and the beauty of being a human is this diversity where like suddenly you're like, well, I don't know. Is that curry a soup? Like it's like, if it was on the menu at an American like steakhouse, they probably would call that a soup. But like, but like, we are so diverse as a species that like, hey, like we have such cultural diversity that it's not gonna, like that word isn't gonna apply in the same place every place. Which brings me back to fish.
Yes.
To put this in like for people who aren't aware of the there is no such thing as a fish argument, we are more closely related to some fish than other fish are to other fish. So the sort of like common ancestor of all fish also includes cats.
Wow.
So if you're either I'm a fish or taxonomically some fish are not fish. But we also look and we say, okay, fish are a certain thing. They look a certain way, they behave a certain way. And just because like taxonomically there isn't a way that we can sort of define fish. And the ways, and by the way, we can do this with like birds, for example. Like birds are a thing. Birds are all commonly related to it. Like they all share have a shared ancestor. Whereas like so it's not always this way, but we still need the word fish. Like we still need to we still need to, a name for that thing that looks like a fish, even if they aren't closely related to each other. They just like converged upon the right shape to be a good water animal boy.
It's like you sort of have to make concessions for the convenience and communicability of it, in a sense. You have to make certain like scientific concessions. This Absolutely. Happens a lot with the concept of red meat versus white meat.
Right.
You know, when the pork board had the single greatest, most manipulative advertising campaign of all time in the 1980s, the pork, the other white meat campaign that, you know, it got people to believe that pork is quote unquote white meat. They literally bred pigs to be leaner, to have less red flesh,
interesting,
to look white. But I mean, the split between white and red meat was typically to describe, you know, nutritional value, levels of saturated fat. White meat has always had a connotation of being healthier.
Yep.
And so for people to, you know, now think that pork is quote unquote white meat, which is, I mean, almost entirely limited to like poultry and and birds.
Right.
It was a great way to sort of trick people because it physically looked lighter. And they were like, well, that can't be red meat because it's quite grayish pink.
That must be good for me.
Must be good
for you.
Yeah, but
it was like, no, you're misunderstanding the point of the taxonomy.
Yeah.
Was to describe levels of saturated fat, et cetera.
Mm. Right.
And so it's a way that like the, you know, the literalism was taken over the side of like utility.
Right, right. So you take a word that has a utility and you want to associate with that utility. And that's the like very specific goal is to associate with a particular utility, even though it actually doesn't apply to that thing. And at that point, it's a trick of like of advertising and of marketing. But this can also just happen. Like it, like that is a thing
naturally.
That was kind of done intentionally, but it's also a thing that could just happen. And especially when you have a word, I've lost my train of thought. Oh, dang it.
Happens
Welcome
all
to the podcast.
The hot dog is a tangent.
So I think we can all, I don't mean to speak for the group, but I think what I have noticed in summation of the argument of, you know, is the ocean a soup, is that the ocean as it stands right now is not a soup. You would maybe need to transmute it using some sort of culinary skill to get it to be an appropriate soup. There is the chance that you could get a bite.
At that point, you're making a soup. And like, you can't make a soup out of a soup. I guess you
Correct.
Could.
True.
Actually. You add the right amount of water to condensed cream and mushroom.
I was just about
soup.
To say, yep.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, Hank. So you are, I use the term the patron saint of sagacity on TikTok, and people have been coming to you for answers for so long. We have discussed many other questions on the show. I want to do a quick lightning round just to get your initial thoughts on some things we've discussed in the past. Do you feel prepared for that?
I do.
All right, cool. So I mentioned many of them are soup related. One, is cereal soup?
No.
Okay.
Are Pop-Tarts ravioli?
Definitely not.
It's correct on that. If you eat a hot dog as it travels through you and your intestines, does a part of you actually become a hot dog? Think about it.
Like, I'm the bun?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're the bun.
I mean, we also call bunless hot dogs hot dogs.
Yes, that's correct. You just eat a hot dog solo.
I eat hot dogs at the pack.
Well, then am I not just a hot dog all the time then? Like, what?
Well, I mean, well, I think it depends
on. You tell me.
So actually, there are legal requirements for, so a hot dog has to be at least 50% plus meat and no more than 30% fat to satisfy the FDA requirements for a hot dog. So it depends on the contents traveling through your intestines at the time. So if you've eaten a balanced breakfast of oats, et cetera, that's filler. And Hank, you're trying to cheapen your intestines to sell to consumers.
I'm definitely not a hot dog. I'm not a hot dog. I'm not a hot dog. I'm a hot dog. A part of me is a hot dog.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of this.
That's fine.
Comes down to how you view yourself, you know?
I do like when things are actually legally defined. Mm-hmm. My favorite one, Mendeleev, the man who made the periodic table, you may have remember him from chemistry class, also worked for the Russian government, and he legally defined what vodka is. So vodka is always the exact same thing. Now, there are people who will tell you that they can taste the difference between different vodkas, but legally, they are the same. They are 60% water, 40% ethanol. That's what vodka is.
Interesting, but also vodka is like the I didn't know that about Mendeleev. That's really fascinating.
That's
but
very cool.
Vodka is everyone thinks it's made from potatoes, but a vast majority of the world's vodkas, it's made from just grains.
Yeah, you don't.
And so
like,
there's like very few legal protections just outside of Mendeleev.
Well, it's I mean, it's just that he defined it that way, and so it just sort of like stuck. And so the like you can make ethanol out of a number of different. You can make it from potatoes. You can make it from grains.
Interesting.
But it's sort of wherever the ethanol comes from. Now, there will be very, very small impurities that are probably different from in potato vodka versus grain vodka. But I cannot imagine a person who could taste them. But maybe that person exists.
I have lied to a Russian waiter at a fancy restaurant and said that I could taste the difference between their vodka flight, but I was just having a really great time. I was playing into it. I was like, oh my God. I can taste the terroir of Poland. Yeah, go to Kaczka in Portland. Unreal restaurant.
Cool.
That sounds good.
Okay, I have one more. I have a few more questions for you. If you stack one lasagna on top of another lasagna, does it become one lasagna?
Yes.
That's a good one. Are Cheetos chips?
No.
Is tomato really a fruit?
Yes. Tomato's absolutely a fruit.
I don't like that.
I think both botanically, which is definitely, but also in terms of how I consume them, they are fruits.
In terms of how you consume?
Yeah, I feel like
you're making fruit sandwiches?
What?
Well, I was going to say.
I could put a pineapple on a sandwich. That's delicious.
I just realized after I said that, I ate a banana sandwich this morning.
Yeah,
so
hello.
I'm like, okay, dummy, let's back that one up real fast. All right, is Kit Kat technically lasagna?
No.
Is cheesecake a pie?
Yes.
Are muffins unfrosted cupcakes?
Yes.
I love that. I love that you looked like a kid in the spelling bee. Who was like reciting, you know, trying to like mouth out the words
and
not allowed to write them. Preston did P-R-E-S-T. All right, Hank, I feel not only great about is the ocean a soup, but also about a lot of our previous discussions.
Me
not that
too.
We needed your validation.
Well,
but
the only one I feel that I'm sort of moving back on is cereal being a soup. And I'm sort of more on the table of potentially cereal being a soup.
Oh, soup. But,
this is where we ended up too. That was a long and emotional one for us. We both cried after.
Yeah.
All right, Nicole and Hank, we've heard what you and I have to say. Now it's time to find out what other wacky ideas are rattling out there in the Twitterverse. It's time for a segment we call
Opinions Are Like Casseroles.
We got to standardize if it's a song, if it's just us saying.
It's sing-songy.
We're going sing-songy for now?
It's sing-songy.
Sing-songy. Okay, we have a non-song. All right. First up, Nicole, you want to rock it?
Sure. Card_tag says, cream cheese is great on pizza with ground beef. The cream cheese will melt but retain its form. Little pockets of melty cream cheese make for an interesting textural experience. Okay. Take it away, Hank.
I'm sorry, I got distracted and I got confused. Oh, okay. I was like, I heard the beginning and I thought that I would understand what was going on, but then I lost my train of thought in the middle and I felt like a spell had been cast on me.
That's what my voice does on people. It's not the first time.
It would appear they're making dolloped pockets of cream cheese on their pizza.
Yeah.
With ground beef.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
any cheese belongs on pizza. Like, the first time I had a barbecue pizza, it was like cheddar cheese and barbecue sauce. I was like, this is an insane idea. And I had it, and I was like, well, turns out cheese on bread is good. So I think one of my favorite pizza toppings in the world is goat cheese. And this seems very similar to that.
I actually think cream cheese might have an advantage to goat cheese in certain forms, only because goat cheese, when you bake it, it gets chalky
on the top.
On the top, yeah. It loses that moisture, and there's so much acid in goat cheese that it kind of almost curdles and gets chalky, and you lose that creaminess. So if you're gonna bake it on top, if hot cheese is important to you, cream cheese is a great way to go, and you get more flavor than ricotta.
Yeah.
To me, this is a beautiful, like, very American innovation on pizza.
Yeah, I put cream cheese in my Italian-esque recipes a lot. I kind of throw a dollop in my pasta sauces,
and it
helps with the texture 100%.
The first time I realized that the line between cream sauce and tomato sauce didn't have to be a hard line was like, I'm free!
Yes.
And this happened Pandora's to me, this happened to me in Italy. I was in Italy, and I got like this amazing lasagna that was creamy tomato-y sauce, and I was just like, what are we doing in America? And this was the 90s, so we have learned since then.
The less libertine 90s. All right, at JBush53, my grandmother in southern Alabama would serve us a dish called pear salad. It was a canned pear half with a dollop of mayo sprinkled with cheddar cheese on a leaf of iceberg lettuce, because it's still a salad. Heck, you were talking about the salad term earlier. I'm curious.
First of all, I don't think that's a salad. Second, it sounds, look, I don't know. It sounds like a food that you eat when necessary.
Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, there are rations. We don't know exactly what foods are going to arrive at the house. And so we will put canned pear on iceberg lettuce.
Yeah, it's like the food that launched a holiday for, like, you know, a major religion. It's like, look, times were hard. This is all we had. This is what we made. Yeah. Now we make it every year.
Yeah. I just don't get it. I just don't get it, guys. I don't understand this.
I think so. Part of this, I mean, my dad sort of grew up in that, like, baby boomer post-war, like, a space race era where they were so fascinated by modern food production technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this huge fascination with commercial canned items. There's a huge fascination with preserved mayonnaise that was shelf stable.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how all this stuff ended up in these recipes where you're like, a canned pear half covered in mayonnaise that I bought at the grocery store and now I'm starting to enter the workforce. There's a sort of fascination with all these foods. Also ditto with tropical fruits because of American neocolonialism into Hawaii and Guam and Puerto Rico.
Totally.
So that's why we see all these weird, quote unquote, banana and pineapple recipes. And so this, I don't know if it would taste good, but it's kind of a cool slice of history.
For sure. Canned pears, I feel like, do have an advantage, which is that they last for more than 12 hours.
Yes.
Between being not ripe and being too ripe.
I've given up on pears. I've given up on fresh pears.
I love fresh pears.
They're so good. They're worth it if you can make it happen. You just have to pay a lot of attention.
I've been burned too many times. How do you ripen a pear appropriately?
I don't. I just buy them and then I touch it and I go, okay, I can eat it now. It's very simple for me.
You push
I love
the,
a good
if you
pear.
Push at the top next to the stem so you don't bruise it. And then you're like, quite hard.
I just kind of cradle it and I slightly see how much give there is.
Get the suppleness of it.
Canned pears remind me of hospital food.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like cafeteria lunch.
Yeah.
Well, they remind me of a very fancy pear preparation that I love and you hate, though.
Poached pears?
The poached pear.
I hate poached pears.
That's very close to canned pear, but you'll pay $18 for it at a restaurant.
I like poached pears. I like hot fruit. Like a banana's Foster? Oh my God.
Yes. I love hot fruit, but poached pears just taste like wine soaked flesh. I don't like it. No, I can't. Luke of the Tory says sous vide heaters are great at keeping the bathtub a comfortable temperature. This is some big brain stuff.
Hank, are you familiar with the sous vide movement?
You like seal up a meat in a bag and then you heat it up, and that way the water never touches it, but it still gets cooked, I guess.
Yeah, so the I guess supposed proprietary technology of the immersion circulator is the name of the actual tool. And some people are very pedantic about not calling it a sous vide cooker. Someone slid in my DMs the other day and they were so mad that I said sous vide cooker instead of immersion circulator.
Interesting.
But anyways, all it does, it's a stick that you put into a water bath and it circulates the water at a controlled temperature. And so that's the big thing. It circulates the water so it heats evenly. But a lot of people have found out that if you kind of just like heat anything to a consistent temperature, it's going to keep that food at that temperature. So if you just find the right setting, like between the 3 and the 4 on your stove, you basically got a sous vide cooker without any of the mess. So I think this person's kind of taking the piss a little bit and being like, sous vide's great for keeping the bathtub at a nice temp.
Could it, would it, that's a lot of, there's a lot of water in a bathtub. Would it be able to, I guess it might, so like you got your heat loss because the water is, you know, warmer than the environment. So you got your heat loss to the air and the tub and et cetera. And so, like, once the water is at a temperature, it's easier to keep it at the temperature. So you just have to fight against the heat loss. You don't have to heat it up.
Yeah.
And but it seems like that would be hard, just because there is quite a lot of heat loss, and
just
also
the sheer volume.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot of water to try and keep it the right temperature. But I don't know. It would definitely help.
We actually did something at Mythical before my time, where they tried to cook something sous vide in a kiddie pool.
Interesting.
And I believe they had about 8 sous vide, 8 immersion circulators strapped around the side.
Right, yeah.
But still, you're fighting a big... I mean, we've tried and failed at a couple big construction things that is not our strong suit. We tried to turn a whole gutted car into a pizza oven, and that did not turn out well. I mean, it was a very fun episode. We just made a bad pizza. I still ate it. Oh, I like this one. At R. La Durell... Our whole lives are just looking for ways to justify our consumption of dips and sauces.
I mean, I think sauces are deeply underrated, even at their current level of, like, I think they're more highly rated than they once were. You know how everybody hates Arby's?
My dad loves Arby's. It's my dad's favorite restaurant.
I'm familiar with the general
it's cool.
Concept,
it's cool to hate Arby's, but...
It is?
There.
Don't tell Morris. Don't tell Hank.
Mind.
Don't tell my dad.
So there was an Arby's in my wife's hometown that in Connecticut, and I, like, if all Arby's were like this, I think everything would turn around for them. Where there was a sauce bar. So Arby's right now has more sauces than the average restaurant. They have horseradish sauce, which is called horsey sauce, and they have Arby's sauce, which is like a weird, not very good barbecue sauce. And then they have ketchup and mustard, and so that's like more than you'd usually get.
More than necessary, really.
No, I disagree. I like all of them. Oh. I get all of the sauces.
I have so much horsey sauce at my house, guys.
I mean, more than like a restaurant is required to serve. They don't have to give you horsey sauce.
More than
they do, and
more than
for.
Is required. Yes, but at this one in Connecticut. There was a sauce bar, and it was like with pumps, and you could like choose and you could mix. And I'm like, this is the revolution we need, because like, look, there's only so many ways I can enjoy a roast beef sandwich. But if I have a lot of different sauces to choose from, I can like mix it up every time. I can be a connoisseur. This can be like wine tasting. So anyway, what was the question?
That was it, man. We have no less than like 35 hot sauces in our. Yeah. But I mean, not like scorch your butt off hot sauces.
Right,
but
just
I mean,
flavors.
Like, yeah, just different
so
flavors.
Many flavors,
and you mix those with different mayonnaises and vinaigrettes. And you know, people say that you know the arts are what gives life context and makes it worth living. To me, like, you know, the meat, the grains, the vegetables are what gives your body nutrition. It is the sauces that make the food worth eating.
Some people like their foods a little saucier than others, though. Have you ever hung out with somebody that just drenches their Subway in, like, sauce? Or, like, when they go to sushi, they just dip it in, like, spicy mayo, ponzu, eel sauce, and a bunch of other sauces? Just like, what are you doing?
It's like when I was a kid and I got all of the sodas in one cup at Burger King.
I think there's a fine line when people are just like, there's too much sauce, and then there's some people that's like, not enough sauce. I think we all fit in that category of... perfect amount of sauce.
I don't know. I can go overboard. My favorite genre of food.
I can go hard for sure.
My favorite genre of food are wet sandwiches.
Salads.
I like wet salads when I'm, you know, trying to eat healthy, but wet, I mean, like a French dip.
Oh my god, Philippe's. I was just gonna say Philippe's.
They physically drop the sandwich in the broth and then lift it out and it sops.
You
and
can
you eat
get
it with your hand. They have the spicy
you can
mustard.
Get it double dipped.
You just
extra
get it
wet. Is a sandwich or soup? Is where we have
at
arrived.
That point,
At that point, you could potentially put a straw in it and suck it up.
You could.
I am 100%
well, the other Gabriel Iglesias has that whole bit about Chico's Tacos where he said it was the first taco that I could drink. And if you look at it, it is three taquitos floating in a quart of sauce.
Oh, amazing.
It's like, that is a soup, sir. Oh, that is a soup, which is also delicious. The ocean.
Man, this podcast makes me very hungry.
I'm also getting hungry. I'm about at that point.
What's your favorite? What's your favorite sauce?
Spicy mayo is my favorite sauce. Any sort of hot sauce plus mayonnaise is my favorite sauce. Yeah. All-purpose sauce.
Yeah.
Favorite sauce. I mean, I have long been a ranch dressing fan. Mm. I grew up eating it, putting it on pizza, on chicken. I would put it on spaghetti and lasagna. But that said, I think I'm now a sauce-free agent where, sauce-free. You know, I think, you know, there's a Vietnamese condiment called Nook Trum. That's like a prepared fish sauce. It's fish sauce, lime, garlic, chilies, and sugar. And to me, that's probably number one on my depth chart. What about you?
I'm between just melted butter because
fair.
I don't know what we did when we made butter, but it's amazing. And I think, but ultimately, really barbecue sauce.
I have a theory that ketchup is technically a barbecue sauce. All right, on that note, thank you for listening to A Hot Dog is a Sandwich. To enjoy more, you got to start talking so no one can respond. To enjoy more Hank Green, you can tag him in TikToks and follow him on YouTube by subscribing to the Vlogbrothers channel. You should also read his New York Times best-selling books, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, or the sequel, A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor. Hank, where else can the listeners check you out?
I think that's good. I have a podcast called SciShow Tangents, which is very fun and weird, where it's a science podcast that is not dissimilar from this, where we hit each other with science facts and then we just make jokes about it.
That's my new commute home podcast.
Yeah. Me too.
All right, and if you want to hear more from us here in the Mythical Kitchen, we got new episodes for you every Wednesday.
If you want to be featured on Opinions Are Like Casseroles, you can hit us up on Twitter at MythicalChef or @Hendizadeh with the hashtag OpinionCasserole.
And of course, if you want to share pics of your dishes, hit us up on Instagram at Mythical Kitchen. See you next time. Hank, thanks again for stopping by.
I had so much fun.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Nicole. This was so cool.